It's At the Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
It's At the Letters for Wednesday, February 8th on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. My name is Arden Zwelling. I'm joined as always by my co-host, Ben Nicholson-Smith. Ben, what is going on today?
So a week from today, it all starts. Crazy, yes. Yeah?
Yeah, it does. It does all start. Kind of feels like it all just ended, but it's all starting again.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. And now we are 1 week away. Obviously, lots of players already down in Dunedin.
Man, they've been there all year, all winter.
Yeah, they basically live there. It's kind of crazy.
Seriously, there's been a whole crew there all winter. I've got a bunch of the prospects that we saw a couple weeks ago who came out to Toronto. I was talking to some of them. They were like, there's a whole gang down here in Dunedin working out.
Gone are the days when players would work off-season jobs, second jobs.
Or just go get boozed all off-season.
Or a bit of both. Right? Yogi Berra, I think, worked at a men's clothing store, 9 to 5.
Really?
Up until, he was in his early 20s, after he made the major leagues.
Yeah, it's not surprising. People forget, major league ballplayers fought in wars and stuff, right?
Yeah.
It's some things have changed.
Yeah, now it's 12 months a year.
Things have changed.
They're always on.
You know what else is changing? I wanted to talk about this very quickly. The pace of play rules. The new yesterday or the other day, the MLBPA said they'd made some recommendations, or maybe the MLB made the recommendations to the MLBPA. I don't know. I should know which way it was. Who cares? Look it up. Use Google. The two recommendations: taking out the 4-pitch intentional walk. So it's just, you just say, hey, we want to walk the guy, take your base. You don't have to actually physically throw the pitches. And then making the strike zone smaller at the knees, bringing it up from right now, it's at kind of the hollow below the kneecap, and they want to bring it up to kind of the top of the kneecap. This is, to me, saying that removing the 4-pitch intentional walk is going to shorten games, it's like saying that building a one-stop Scarborough subway extension is going to fix Toronto transit, right? Maybe it's going to help a few people, but you need that downtown relief line. The same thing applies here. Maybe you'll save, I don't know, this is an intentional walk, something that happens less than once a game. So maybe you'll save seconds here and there.
They're at an all-time low, which is the funny thing.
Right?
So you would actually save maybe a couple seconds.
A couple seconds? You're not addressing the problem.
No.
You're not helping the pace of play problem at all. I think it's absurd.
Yeah, the bigger issue, I don't know if we're going to say it's a problem because it's just the way the game is going, but
yes,
when you have so many pitching changes, and we are going to have more pitching changes again this year, it's going to continue progressing in that direction. When you have so many pitching changes, you have a lot of mound visits, you have a lot of breaks to get the new pitcher to the mound,
yes,
and that slows the game down. I think that's one of the bigger issues, and hitters' work counts now. There's no such thing as a guy who goes up there trying to just slap the first pitch he sees. Hitters really work the count, and you just have a lot of pitchers, a lot of pitching changes. That's the way the game has gone.
And to the strike zone point, hitters going to work the count even more. If there's a smaller strike zone, I don't think that's going to encourage guys to swing. The idea is that it's going to encourage pitchers to be in the zone more often. Guys throw so hard these days, they don't know where this thing's going. We always overestimate how much command pitchers actually have of their pitches and how surgical they can be. I don't think this is going to help.
Yeah, and it's not just the pace of play that's the question. It's what happens during that period of time of let's call it 3 hours when you're watching a baseball game.
Right.
And right now, you don't see a lot of contact. You don't see a lot of defensive plays because there's so many strikeouts, so many walks, so many home runs.
Yeah.
Just as a little tangent along these lines, I went down a big rabbit hole recently. And yes, this was a 1982 Brewers rabbit hole. I really focused on them the last little while.
This was your Saturday night, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And my Sunday. I was reading this great book called 9 Innings, and then that got me thinking about the Brewers. And so I watched this game, this 1982 Brewers game, and it was between the Brewers and Cardinals in the World Series. Oh my goodness, there was so much contact.
Right.
I saw a sacrifice fly where two runners scored.
What?
One guy from second, one guy from third. It was amazing. This is the kind of baseball that's so much fun to watch. And I love watching current baseball as well. It's just different. But when you compare the two eras, you really get such a contrast, between now when you get so much strikeouts and then you have two runners scoring on a sacrifice fly.
I think you want balls in play. That's what you want. And I think you're on to something about how the increase in strikeouts over recent years and also the increase in walks is that slowed the game down for sure. And you're just getting less action. You know, you're getting less. You want balls in play. So I think the changing the strike zone, like you want low strikes because low strikes lead to guys swinging at low pitches, which lead to ground balls. And ground balls are awesome because ground balls, you get action.
Yep.
You don't get a fly ball and the ball's sailing through the air and you're just watching a guy camp under it. You got to make a play on a ground ball, man. You can beat out a ground ball. You can't beat out a fly ball. So I'm all about more ground balls. So I don't agree with these with the strike zone change or the intentional walk one, which I think the difference is going to be so negligible.
Yeah, the walk one is the funny one. And the strike zone one, that's a big shift. And when you think about how many, this is a point Jason Stark made recently, but when you think about how many pitchers exist in Major League Baseball, well, there are a lot of them, and they might actually want to have a bigger strike zone. So if you're talking about making a change that's going to have to be approved by a pitcher-heavy union, it's not necessarily going to be easy to shrink that strike zone.
That's a very good point. I think that, you know, there are these like little changes you can make. Like you could limit mound conferences, say, you know, for a mound conference without a pitching change, you get 2 per game or 3 per game. Or maybe 1 per pitcher or something like that, right? And you say, that's your limit. Use them wisely. So you can't delay the game that way. I would personally very much like to see the replay system change to more of an NFL system where you can't come up to the top step of the dugout and hold the game hostage with your arm up while your guy in the back watches the replay 50 times.
Yeah.
It's either you get a challenge flag.
Yeah.
Throw it or don't. And throw it before the next pitch. That's the time you've got. So you've probably got about 30 to 40 seconds to figure your stuff out. You can't hold the game hostage. I hate that when you just see everybody on the field's ready to go and there's Gibby on the top step with his arm up, right?
The managers don't like it either.
No, and to their credit, they're playing the system the way that they're making the rules work for them. They're using them to their advantage. But change stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. The replay is one big spot where you could do it. I think mountain conferences are for a viewer, they're really boring.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know, does that mean you mic the pitching coach and have it
air? That would be so awesome.
I mean, I think it would be awesome. And maybe you can't have it live. Maybe it has to be embargoed for 5 minutes or something like that. But there are ways to make it more entertaining. But watching these guys cover their mouth with their glove, stand out on the mound for 30 seconds, I mean, it's not great entertainment compared to these elite athletes who are so highly trained. This should be an entertaining product. And in many ways, for the most part, it is. I mean, we love baseball. It's fun watching baseball. But a lot of the time, there are those little lulls that they could probably cut back on.
Well, that's the other thing is that we love baseball and we love that it's a leisurely sport. And we love that it takes some, I love that it takes some time. One of my favorite things about baseball is there's no clock, is you just keep playing until it's over. You play until the game's done. So there's no like gimmicks that come in like shootouts or 3-on-3 or any of this crap, or you start with the ball on the 25-yard line, try to score. Like you just, you play the game out, and maybe baseball just has to embrace, because they're never going to catch up with the NBA or, you know, the NHL in terms of speed and action and stuff. Maybe you just embrace the fact that, look, we offer a retro throwback product.
Yeah.
Because maybe you just say, this is what we do. This is what we are. Look, revenues are at an all-time high. Fans aren't, you know, abandoning the game. Look around this city. There's tons of young baseball fans.
Yeah. I think you just want as entertaining a product as possible. I'm fine sitting down and watching 3 hours and 20 minutes of baseball every night.
Yeah.
No question about that.
We do it about 162 times a year.
Yeah, exactly. And then the only question is, let's just make that as much action-oriented and as little John Gibbons holding up his arm and we're all waiting to see if they challenge.
I think the thing, and my last thing on this, is that, look, if you really want to make change, you have to bring in a pitch clock. I mean, that's the one thing that I think would really change stuff up. So you can't get these relievers who are taking like 35 seconds between pitches. You can't get these Jason Frazers out here. It's, you know, you give them whatever you want to give them, 24, 25 seconds, enough time that a guy should reasonably be able to get a sign and check a runner and throw a pitch. And you can look, you can grandfather it in, you can start it in, you know, college, the minor leagues, and do like a 5-year process so that, you know, a full cycle of a, you know, 5-year development comes up with the pitch clocks through college and minor leagues. That also gives established major leaguers enough time to know the change is coming and to work on it in the off season and adjust to their routine, to how they're going to do it. And then you move to that. I mean, that's the real way you can really tighten up the game, I think.
There are some rules too that umpires could enforce you know, rules that exist now, that if they were to enforce them,
batter's box.
Yeah. Or each, you know, guys adjusting their gloves, pitchers. Yeah. I think there's a rule in the rule book on how long pitchers have to deliver the ball.
Yeah. It's just not enforced.
Right.
Yeah. So you just need that big clock out in center field behind.
You know. I don't know if I love the big clock, but I see what you're saying.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You can't have the ump with like a stopwatch. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't know how else you're going to do it. I mean, like, ump's supposed to keep track of time in his head. That's a pretty unreliable system.
Well, it would add an entertainment result to the game. Yeah. I don't know about the clock, but
the batter's box thing for sure. I can't tell you how many times last year I saw David Ortiz after like taking a ball step out of the batter's box to, you know, clap his hands and stuff, right? And like adjust his gloves. Yep. That's supposed to be against the rules. You're supposed to stay in the batter's box.
Yeah.
It's just not called. Anyway, the Toronto Blue Jays, this is the Blue Jays podcast. The Toronto Blue Jays, since we last recorded, have signed a man by the name of Joe Smith. Joe Smith is a right-handed reliever. He was once quite good. Last year, not so much. The Blue Jays are betting $3 million that he can bounce back. Another kind of cost-effective, low-money move on a bullpen arm that could bounce back, much in the mold of one J.P. Howell.
Yeah, it's seemingly a depth move, not someone that you're going to have pitching the late innings or the super high leverage spots.
Right.
But as someone with a pretty low arm slot and a history of retiring right-handed batters, Smith seems capable of stepping in when you have a run of right-handed hitters coming up and doing a pretty good job against them. So that's the role that I would expect him to fill. It's not that exciting of an addition compared to some of the other ones you'll see, you know, even at this point in the offseason, but definitely earlier in the winter. But he's a serviceable player, and he helps their bullpen.
The line I would draw between J.P. Howell and Joe Smith is both extreme ground ball guys, very high ground ball rates. And look, you play at the Rogers Center. So if you're a pitcher, you want to keep that ball on the ground. And you've got a pretty decent infield around you. Josh Donaldson, Troy Tulowitzki, Devin Travis, whether it's Goins or Barney in that utility infielder role, I mean, you're going to have pretty good defense behind you. Blue Jays pitchers are pretty decent at fielding their position. Stroman and Sanchez, very athletic guys. I think perhaps there is a strategy here. Maybe it's just these are the two guys that wanted to come here and that were available at the rate or whatever. But I wonder if maybe there's a strategy here of getting ground ball guys for the bullpen.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't hurt, especially in this park, to have guys who can keep it on the ground. And neither one of these guys is going to overpower you either. I mean, you look at Howell, he's closer to 85 miles an hour, and Smith was around 88.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about guys who are going to blow it past you. So if they have the ability to pitch at the bottom of the strike zone, get those ground balls, then it could end up working out for the Jays.
Perhaps this gives the Blue Jays a bit of wiggle room, I guess. That's not the word I'm looking for, but with Joe Biagini. You know, it looked like before Howell and Smith were in the bullpen that Joe Biagini absolutely had to be a reliever. Now, you know, the Blue Jays are going to stretch him out in spring because, of course, you're going to stretch him out because if you can stretch out a guy, you might as well. Now the Blue Jays kind of have some flexibility there, and they maybe don't absolutely direly need Joe Biagini in this bullpen, and he can perhaps slot in as a sixth starter.
Yeah, I think that, and I'm sure they'll stretch him out, but I do think you kind of want him in the bullpen.
You do, but I mean, I think the Blue Jays have enough arms now where they can at least early in the season, you know, try it out and maintain some flexibility and maintain some starting depth, because they don't have an awful lot of starting pitching depth.
No, they definitely don't. And I could see them adding on that front. I think they're working to add one more depth starter type, even after adding Smith and Howell. But, you know, you wonder, like, for example, with Biagini, would you see them in a position where they could start him at AAA and have him start the season in the AAA rotation?
Well, and the thing is, I think he would be amenable to that. You know, like, he's not a big ego guy. I think that he would be, you know, I think he appreciates that the organization took a chance on him last year, kept him in the majors all season. So I think he would be okay with filling that Drew Hutchison role. Like, everybody wants to be in the big leagues, but I think he might, you know, he would understand it perhaps a bit more than someone such as Drew Hutchison did. Drew Hutchison spent the entire year pissed off, right? Yep. So, you know, I think Joe Biagini would, you know, and he's got to start his repertoire. He really does. You know, he's got four or five pitches, and he was a starter coming up. Last year was his first year as a reliever. So, you know, if Joe Biagini is automatically going to be your sixth best starter, I feel like you almost have to, in a way, at least try it, at least maintain that flexibility. Because who becomes the sixth best starter if Joe Biagini's in the bullpen?
Oh yeah, no, it's thin. I mean, I think that Bolsinger, who also could be in the bullpen, would be one of those number six type guys. You've got Gavin Floyd, but no one can count on him to be healthy after after what we saw last year, and him not pitching after June. So you're right. I mean, this is a clear weakness. This is why I wouldn't be stunned if they were to go out and sign, you know, along the lines of what we talked last week, Edwin Jackson, Matt Latos, that type of guy is still out there. Wouldn't be stunned to see them make that type of addition. But I don't know if I'm the Jays, I don't think I'm willing to sacrifice Biagini in the bullpen to obtain that depth.
Yeah, I mean, we were lobbying last week for, you know, go get a converted starter, you know, because those guys, I think, bring you so much value in that they can, look, yeah, they can be a depth starter. They can be, you know, ramp it up and be a good bullpen arm like Gavin Floyd did last year. They can be a swing man and, you know, they can pitch multiple innings. You can spot start them. They really do give you a lot of flexibility. You can really, you know, mold the clay however you want to. You know, when I look at this bullpen, you mentioned Mike Bolsinger, out of options.
Yes.
So if, you know, are Mike Bolsinger and Joe Biagini both going to be in a Toronto Blue Jays bullpen? You know, do you need one of them to be a depth starter? Well, you know, like the way, if you're preserving flexibility, Mike Bolsinger out of options, throw him in the bullpen. Joe Biagini very much has options. So you could option him to AAA and have him remain a starter.
He does. That being said, to me, he's probably their, I mean, as soon as obviously the best reliever. Is Biagini
I would agree with that.
The second best? Third best?
Yeah, I mean, Jason Grilli, you know, I think JP Howell's going to be really good.
Sure.
You know, or at least he can be.
But if Biagini is clearly in the top four of your bullpen,
yes,
that's a loss, you know, to ship him to Buffalo. Even though I agree it's a need and it's nice to have him stretched out, I would have him in the big leagues one way or the other.
I always look to, you know, because like, look, the Blue Jays are going to use like 20 relievers next year or something. Yeah. Like they're going to use a ton, right? So, you know, your bullpen, it's almost like a folly to even talk about what's this bullpen going to look like out of spring training.
100%.
Because the bullpen opening day is going to be different from the bullpen on the first day of the second series, right, of the year, you know? So it's like, it's such a flexible thing. And I think that at the end of spring, the Blue Jays might look at who has options. They might look at preserving flexibility. And they're going to say, do we want to expose Mike Bolsinger to waivers? Bo Schultz doesn't have options. Do we want to expose Bo Schultz to waivers? Bo Schultz throws really, really hard. And that's the kind of guy that, you know, other teams, I think, are willing to take a chance on, you know, by making a waiver claim on him. Because, like, look, this guy throws 97, 98. Maybe we can work with him. Maybe there's something here. You know, that kind of velocity is in demand. So I think the Blue Jays are going to try to keep as many of their assets as they can. It's going to be tricky with Schultz and Bolsinger both out of options.
Absolutely. And then if you look at a guy like Floyd, for example,
yeah,
you know, if you expect that he's going to be pretty capable, well, he's probably going to be in the big league bullpen too. So that's where a guy like Aaron Loop, who has options, probably a good chance that he starts in the minors. Glenn Sparkman, Rule 5 pick.
Right.
Good chance he's gone. You know, good chance he's sent back to KC.
It's so hard to see Sparkman fitting into this right now. It's so hard to see him fitting with the Jays. And look, they took him because obviously they like him. Like, they took him in the Rule 5 draft for a reason. But it's just with some of the additions there's been, I think the probability of him sticking around has gotten very low. You mentioned Gavin Floyd. I think he's got the inside track for, you know, kind of a long man, swing man role in the bullpen.
Sure.
Really?
I mean, it all depends on health with him.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, familiarity with him. He was so good last year when he was healthy. You know, Gibby likes him. Obviously, the front office likes him. You know, and he's a guy who, you know, if you're going to be outriding him or whatever you're doing at the end of spring training to get him to Buffalo, he's a guy who might say, I'm going to take free agency because I feel like I can catch on somewhere else and maybe have a better opportunity.
Right. And I don't know the specifics of his contract, but he could have an opt-out.
Yeah.
Some of these veteran types do. And then that creates pressure on the Jays to make a decision on him one way or the other. So, it, you know, as you said, we can pin the Blue Jays opening day bullpen down right now, and we could even get it 100% accurate, and it would shift. Like, it's going to be constant churn. It's almost, you know, to the biggest extent that it's ever been, like, these guys are just pieces. Like, they're just pieces on a chessboard, and they're always moving around.
Just pawns in this great game.
They are the pawns. They are the middle relievers are definitely the pawns.
So if you're looking at it right now, you can pretty much lock in Osuna, Grilli, how will Smith be a genie, right? Like, yeah. I do think Biagini is going to be in the Blue Jays bullpen. Like, I think the Blue Jays are going to think long and hard about whether they want to preserve starting depth with him. But if, as you mentioned, if they add another kind of, swingman starter on a minor league deal or something like that, someone they can get to Buffalo, then they don't really have to. Yeah, that doesn't leave a lot of room. And you always wonder about who would emerge in spring training as kind of an under the radar guy, like, Brett Oberholzer type, or one of these minor league guys, or Lionel Campos or whatever, some of these guys who are on the 40 have options, but maybe they have a wicked spring. And you remember when Osuna and Castro played their way onto the team, right? And that was obviously a pretty exceptional circumstance and under a different administration that was more willing to rush guys to the majors. It's not out of the question that somebody has a lights out spring and plays their way onto this side.
Exactly. And that's always the fun part about spring training, because then you see some of these guys kind of emerge out of nowhere when realistically there are more established arms around. But, once the season gets going, they are going to have some amount of flexibility to adjust on performance.
This is really the only battle we're looking at, eh? I guess backup catcher and bullpen are really maybe left field.
Yeah,
I guess.
Throw left field more than backup catcher, because I think Salty's basically the guy.
You're already calling him Salty.
I mean, he's got. We're gonna call him Salty.
We're gonna call him Salty.
Yeah, I guess.
I'm trying with the Saltalamacchia. I like saying it, Saltalamacchia. I like saying it, but anyway,
I think he's got the inside track.
You'd have to assume that he does. Yes, he's the only guy who's played in the majors that they have. Yep. Right? I guess Gratterall's probably got a few games.
Nine or so.
Yeah, he's the only guy with major league experience. So automatically he is, head and shoulders above the rest. Left field competition, interesting.
Well, what about Pompey? I mean, what if he really shows them something? That's the question that I would wonder about.
I wonder if they feel like they still want him to develop more. Like last year was a tough year for him with injuries. He never really got like a true stretch of playing time. Where he was kind of at his best and in his groove. I wonder if they're still, I think Dalton Pompey might just be like a late blooming type of guy, right?
How much development time does he get though? I mean, this is his last year with options. This time next spring, he's out of options.
You might as well use him this year.
And they will. I'm sure they will. But I don't know. If he can help you this year, I think you have to take him north.
Yeah, no, if he has a wicked spring, I mean, maybe you have to look at getting out from, a Melvin Upton or an Ezekiel Carrera. I think the easiest thing for the Blue Jays to do, though, would be to just kind of, sort of platoon those two in left field, Carrera and Upton, and send Pompey to Buffalo to play every day and continue working.
And that's my expectation.
That's my expectation, too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think it's as much of a battle. Because I think the Blue Jays really do like Carrera, and I think they believe there is something in Upton. Upton showed, he really wasn't very good as a Blue Jay, but before that with the Padres, I mean, he was pretty good. He in a worse hitting environment, he was pretty good. So I think the Blue Jays really believe there's something in there. And there's also the fact that, I mean, they're only paying him $1 million. So they're kind of thinking hey, let's see if we can get some crazy value out of this.
Yeah.
I don't see them cutting bait on either of those two quickly.
Right. If anything, it would be at the very end of spring training when you tend to see that last shuffle of moves, and those are their jobs to lose for sure. I think that the status quo would have them starting and involved in some sort of a platoon in left field.
And the thing is, if you say you did say, all right, Dalton Pompey is going to be our starting left fielder this year, say you have to get rid of an Upton or a Carrera, whichever one. Then say Dalton Pompey does what he did 2 years ago when he was the starting center fielder out of camp and falters and doesn't do very well and has to be sent back down. Well, now your insurance policy behind him is not looking so good because it's one of Carrera or Upton. I mean, the safe play for the Blue Jays is to go with Carrera and Upton, who at least have major league experience and have proven they can get it done in the majors, and let Pompey keep developing. I know fans don't love that, but it's the safe play for the organization, no?
At the same time, they have Siciliani behind those guys. And I mean, I get what you're saying, that at a certain point, you're just eroding the talent base that you have.
Yeah.
And you don't want to do that too much. But this is also, the Jays aren't good enough where they can afford to turn their nose up at small advantages. I think anytime that they have a player that they think is truly better, they have to go with that player and hope that that's reflected in the standings.
I guess it depends on if you think like Dalton Pompey is going to be the piece that puts you over the top.
Yes.
The piece that moves the needle in terms of wins, you know?
Exactly.
And it's hard for me to imagine him proving that in spring training. Maybe. We'll see.
Yeah.
That's what spring's all about, man.
Exactly.
That's what spring's all about. You can win yourself a job. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a Japanese baseball player that you perhaps have heard of and maybe you haven't. All that and much more when we come back on At The Letters.
We are back on At The Letters, still in studio, still Ben Nicholson-Smith here and Arden Swelling. And Arden, we're going to talk about a pretty cool piece that you wrote about Shohei Ohtani. So it should be a lot of fun to discuss this. The Japanese Babe Ruth. I wanted to start just by getting a sense of what it was like being around this guy, because you're one of the few people who has had the chance to talk to him, to be around him. What's he like?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do the story. It was because you can read it on sportsnet.ca. It's the big read up there, and you can see it on my Twitter, Shohei Ohtani, the next Babe Ruth. It was because, like, we've all heard about him, or at least if you're a baseball fan, you've probably heard about him. You've probably seen some YouTube videos. Maybe you've seen some breakdowns of, you know, his stats and the amazing things that he's been able to do playing both ways. But we don't really know anything about him as a guy or as a dude or like what his life's like in Japan or anything like that. And that's kind of how I pitched the story. I was like, we don't know anything about him. Like, nobody's done this yet. Let's do it. So, yeah, I went to Japan and did it. Spent a day with him. And so, you know, be like, the first thing you notice about him is that he's a monster. So he's massive. 6'5", 220. Not like a skinny tall guy, like a built ball tall guy, like a quarterback. He's huge. And you also notice that, like, he can't go anywhere in Japan without massive fanfare. I mean, he is a celebrity, like on par with, you know, actors and actresses and pop stars and stuff over there. I mean, he's got a whole like tabloid beat that follows him.
Wow.
I was on the cover of tabloids in Japan.
Really?
I was on a Japanese tablet.
Let's see
my
these.
Picture. I've got it on my phone.
Oh my goodness!
I'll show you right now. I'll tweet it when this comes up. But
we'll embed it in the post, and we also have linked to Arden's article, the big read on Shohei Ohtani within the post. But I did not realize that you're now tabloid material in Japan. This is great.
Yeah, buddy. Here, look at this.
Wow! There you are. You can, and there's an arrow going from Arden's eyes to Ohtani. What is going on here?
Yeah, man.
This is odd. Do you have the physical copy too?
I do. Yeah, I got a physical copy at home. Yeah.
And, wow.
So yeah, I was it, like, he's just got a beat that follows him around.
Cool.
So it was like news that I was even there to talk to him. Like, they scrummed me and the whole deal.
They scrummed you?
They scrummed me through an interpreter.
What did they ask you?
You know, like, why did you want to come here and talk to Ohtani? What do you know about him? Is he popular in the United States and Canada? Do you want him to go to Toronto?
Like, what did you say?
I was like diplomatic about it, right? Yeah. I was like, well, I want him to go to whatever team is the best fit for him, you know? And, you know, I want him to, right? Like, obviously it'd be awesome to watch him play 162 times a year, but I was like, yeah, no, I want him to go to whatever team is going to be, it's going to be good for him. So.
Wow. Very diplomatic.
It was a funny experience.
Was that weird being scrummed?
I've like been on the other side of it a few times. So I like, it's not that weird. It was a little strange that like it was like eight Japanese reporters and there's a language barrier.
Yeah.
And like a quick story at the end, they were like getting me to spell my name and they were like, and how old are you? And I was like, I'm 29. And the interpreter told them and they all went like, whoa. And I tasked the interpreter and I was like, what's going on here? The interpreter talked to them. The interpreter's like, oh, they thought you were much older than that. I was like, come on, man.
Wow.
Jeez. And I was like, so I told him, I was like, yo, tell them that, look, I've got like the big beard going right now. Like, trust me, like I just need to shave. And he told them, and a female Japanese reporter in English was like, yes, yes, you must.
That's great.
It's like, come on.
Wow.
Help me out here.
So that is memorable in itself. Okay, so this is all to say that this guy is a huge star there.
Yes.
So, okay.
Yeah,
so
he's got a whole tabloid beat that follows him around.
Wow.
When he got his passport renewed a few weeks ago, they tailed him to the airport. Like, it's crazy. He can't do anything without these people following him around.
So, yeah, within the story, you get the sense that he has a very structured life and that much of his life is spent at a team complex. Is that right? Is that how to describe it?
That's where he lives. He lives there. Yeah, he lives at the team, like at their minor league complex and at their major league stadium. They have like dormitories for players. Because in Japan, it's typical if you're under the age of 25 for you to live in a dorm. Like, it's still a very much, you know, it's very much a respect thing. And, respecting your elders and hierarchies and stuff are still huge in Japan. Seniority is a huge thing. So young players live in dormitories. And even if you're the best player in the country, he's still just 22. So he still lives in the dorm. He doesn't make as much money as he's the third highest player on his team.
Okay.
He's the best player in the league. Third highest player on his team, you know? And that's just like a seniority thing. He lives in a dorm, not unlike, you know, the one you lived at in university, not unlike Soggy and Maitland, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you think about 22-year-olds with a lot of money, you'd think that they would get up to, you know, some sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, extracurriculars. And I didn't get the sense in reading your piece that was the case with Ohtani.
It's not. It's absolutely not. And I talked to a lot of people for this piece, and everyone that I talked to over there was like, he's never been seen out enjoying nightlife. He doesn't leave the dorm. People with the team, journalists. I mean, everybody that I talked to was like, yeah, no, he doesn't like leave. He doesn't go out. And the thing is, he can't walk down a street without being recognized. And he's got these tabloid, you know, photographers and reporters that follow him everywhere he goes. So if he was going out, he would be noticed. And he just doesn't. He does. All he does is he works out and he works at baseball, and then he goes home and he goes back to his dorm, and either he reads or he plays PlayStation or he like hangs out with teammates. He likes movies. He likes sports movies a lot. Like, he's a big Remember the Titans fan. He likes Rudy. And he just, that's like what he does. Like, he's just not, there's no extracurriculars to speak of. It's amazing.
So you saw the workouts or some of his off season prep. So what were those like? Like, what's it like watching him work out?
Super cool. So it was like 0 degrees Celsius, I want to say, maybe a degree above. And he was outside, like, playing long toss, going through a throwing program. And this is in like the dead of the off season, right? Like, this, their spring training hadn't started yet. Like, there was no one requiring him to do this work. And he was like, which is kind of, you know, it's a Japanese, the work ethic in Japanese baseball is through the roof. When I got there, I got to the minor league complex to meet him. I got there at 9 a.m. He wasn't even awake yet. And so I was just kind of wandering around, just checking out their minor league complex, which was huge and sprawling. And it was like really cool. And I kind of walked into these batting cages. It's 9 in the morning. And there is a member of the Nippon Ham Fighters in the batting cage at 9 in the morning, bunting.
Wow.
In the middle of the off season. And I watched this guy take like 50 pitches from a pitching machine, just laying down bunts.
Wow.
In the middle of winter.
That is dedication. That is
absolutely.
I don't think Josh Donaldson is doing that. Nor should he, for the record.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
No coach with him or anything. He was just bunt just for his own just progress, just bunting. So that's kind of the work ethic we're dealing with. So yeah, Shohei Ohtani was like out in the cold, going through a whole throwing program. You know, he was working out. I watched him take BP for like a good hour with against a lefty pitcher, like a guy who was actually pitching, and he was just roping the ball. I mean, he is all fields power. He's got such a like smooth swing. It's not like you see a lot of Japanese swings with like the big leg kick and they really kind of load back. His is just really simple. It's just a slight leg kick, a little stride. And then he just like is smooth and quick to the ball and just kind of lets his like long levers, because he's so long and big, kind of do the work and provide the power.
He's a left-handed hitter?
He is a left-handed hitter, and he pitches right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Righty pitcher, left-handed hitter. Nice. Somehow he is also ambidextrous. Like, yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, I guess of all people, it makes sense that he would be.
Yeah.
So one quote in here that kind of caught my attention, because his team won the championship last
Yes,
year.
They won the NPB like regular season, and then they won the Japan series as well.
So great year. And then he says, Last year we won, but I didn't feel like a winner. I didn't feel ready. It's hard to explain. I mean, I don't know what to make of this. That's a bit of a confusing quote. What do you think?
I pressed him on that several times. And remember, we're doing this through an interpreter, right? But I pressed him on it because he was telling me this and I'm hearing it from the interpreter. I'm like, well, what does he mean? Like, what else does he want to, I was like, what else do you want to accomplish? And he's like, well, there's nothing else I want to accomplish in Japan. I mean, I've won everything there is to win. And I was like, yeah, so what do you mean you weren't satisfied? And he kept saying, like, it's just a feeling. I just didn't feel satisfied. I wasn't happy with it. So I think part of it could be he missed about a month and a half of pitching last year with a blister. He had a very similar problem to Rich Hill where it was on his middle finger. And so he wasn't able to start. So he didn't even qualify really for the ERA title, even though his ERA was by far the best in the NPB. And he still got up to, I think, like 140 innings. But so I think that might have been part of it. And the thing is, like, he responded to that injury of not being able to start by just raking at the plate.
Yeah.
He just hit more. So he almost got up to 400 plate appearances last year. He had over a thousand OPS. I mean, it was amazing. He hit 22 bombs, like, took a ton of walks. And he, like, in the second half of the season, pitchers stopped giving him pitches to hit. Like, they were treating him like Barry Bonds. So he saw 35% of his pitches last year in the strike zone, which is the fourth lowest in the NPB, which is amazing.
35%. That would be, like, the lowest in Major League Baseball, right?
I think definitely the lowest in Major League Baseball. Wow. And like, it wild, you know, like it was like he was Barry Bonds. They wouldn't pitch to him. So he ended up having to, like, take walks and, you know, work counts and stuff, like, cause he doesn't have any holes in his swing. He has the same hole that every tall left-handed hitter has, which is, like, right at the belt buckle inside heat, right? How many times have you watched Michael Saunders have trouble with that? So he has that same hole, but he's working on it, right? He's so long, it's tough for him to pull his hands in and get to, like, a really hard inside pitch right at his belt. But, you know, that's it. Otherwise, you put the ball anywhere else in the strike zone, he's going to drive it. Opposite field power, I think 7 of his 22 home runs were to the opposite field. And we're not talking like wall scrapers, like, you know, ticker tape, like long, like tape measure home runs.
So last year, the guys who saw the smallest percentage of pitches in the zone, David Ortiz, 37%, Bryce Harper, 38%.
Shohei Ohtani, 35%.
Yeah. So they're scared of him.
They're absolutely, they're terrified of him. Right. Yeah. And I mean, and the thing is that a lot of the time he hits leadoff because when he would start games. So the Ham Fighters play in a DH league, right? So when he would start games, the Fighters would waive the right to their DH and say, no, we'll just let our pitcher hit. And so Ohtani would hit, and they'd bat him leadoff so they could get the most at-bats out of him before he left the game. Huh. And then when he exited the game in like the 7th or 8th inning, the Fighters were taking a major hit to the batting order because they didn't have their DH, right? And now they had the pitcher spot in the lineup. But it was worth it to them to get those 3 at-bats of Ohtani at leadoff.
Wow.
Through the game.
So it's actually the opposite of batting the pitcher 9th.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. They wanted it. So he was hitting like top of the order when he started. And then when he would play DH in between his starts and hit 5th. Cool. Part of the order bat.
Wow. You talked to a lot of other people about his potential and what kind of player he is now, how he stacks up to major league hitters and pitchers, and how that might project in the big leagues. What kind of sense do you get about where he stands in relation to top major league talent?
I was told that he is ready today to step into the front of the major league rotation or to play every day in right field or a DH for a major league team and hit in the heart of the order and hit 20 to 25 home runs.
Wow.
From multiple scouts. And I've got a scout quoted saying that in the story. I mean, this is the talent. Like, we're talking about once in a lifetime generational talent. I mean, he is just so tremendously athletic. Like, if he had chosen to play basketball or golf or whatever, I think he would have been just as good at those sports, you know? Like, he's just naturally gifted. He's like, you think about this. He was clocked running from home to first base in 3.89 seconds last year. Like, that was what he generally did home to first in. Billy Hamilton does it in 3.85. So we're talking about a guy who has near Billy Hamilton speed.
He's a burner.
Right? And this is like another element to his game. He's just a natural athlete. He's just that gifted. You know, you can get really deep into some of his highlight tapes and you'll see stuff, you'll see him like beating out ground balls to short, like ground, like in the hole ground balls, and he beats them out. Wow. It's incredible. So that's the kind of talent, like we're talking about a guy who's talented enough to be, you know, an all-star in the majors at least today. He was worth 10 wins last year in the NPB. So even if you give him a bit of a hit because the NPB is not quite as good as the MLB, you're still talking about a, I don't know, 6-win player.
Yeah.
How much of a hit do you want to give him, right? Like that's an aggressive hit too.
And you also wonder, I mean, how would you even, like if you're talking about a guy who hits and pitches and say he's like a 6-win position player and a 4 or 5-win pitcher, yeah, then like he could be the best player in baseball.
Most valuable player in the game. And yeah, I think that's what's going to be so fascinating is how an MLB team will utilize him. Because I do think he'll come over to the MLB at some point. I believe it'll be next season, but we'll see.
Wow.
Yeah, I think he wants to be here.
So do you think that could happen next year?
I think so, yeah. Cool. I believe he'll come over next year. That's my belief. But
let's hope so.
Look, if he wants to really cash in, he has to wait until 2019 because of the spending restrictions. But I believe that he'll come over next year. And how an MLB team uses him will be really interesting. Because look, you do have to manage workload here. He's still a human being, right?
Yep.
And right now he's in Japan. He's on a 6-man rotation. Pitches. He starts only once a week. So, you know, an MLB team would have to, you know, plan for that on a 5-man rotation to be pitching more often. You know, how do you use him? Do you use him as a starter and DH him in between? If you're in an NL club, do you use him as a starter and maybe he plays a game or two of right field? Maybe you use him as like a Miller Betances type, right? Like maybe you use him as like a high leverage reliever who can get you 4 or 5 outs even, right? Who could, you know, get up to 80, 90 innings. He's been stretched out as a starter, so it wouldn't be, you know, tough for him to get up to 80, 90 innings as a relief pitcher. And then he starts every day as a DH or right fielder, and then you get to a crucial point at the end of the game, you bring him in a pitch.
Now pitching the DH.
Right?
Wow. Yeah, that'd be cool. So he could start every day as a position player, and then you just transfer him in when he needs to pitch.
Maybe that's the way you do it. Maybe that's how you preserve his arm. Because look, the thing that worries me about the guy is that he throws 102. And he told me that he thinks he can throw harder.
Yeah, he was saying like up to 106 or something.
He said he thinks that he can throw up to 105 or 106.
Okay.
That's what he says. Wow. And look, at 22, this guy was throwing 99 when he was 16,
yeah,
right? So like, you know, he's up to 102 now and he thinks he's still working on his mechanics. He thinks his mechanics can get better. He thinks he's still getting stronger, especially in his lower half, which is where a lot of your power comes from. He thinks he can still throw hard. That's the thing that concerns me, is that he's going to blow out his arm because he throws so hard.
Yeah.
And he's throwing 102 like in the eighth inning, you know, like he's like, reminds me of Verlander a bit, where he actually throws harder as the game goes on. So that can, you know, I think as a team wanting to use him as a starter, that would concern me a little bit.
Yeah. Do you get the sense, and there's a quote in here along these lines, where he says, hitting and pitching is the only baseball I know. Doing only one and not the other doesn't feel natural to me. So that suggests that he would want to be a two-way player if he comes to the majors.
Yeah, I think he will want to. And I think that teams might be put in a position where that's the only, they have to offer him that. Because look, it's a $20 million posting fee to get to negotiate with him. That's all it is. And you only pay the $20 million if you actually sign him. So, you know, any team that can afford $20 million should be, you know, posting for him. And if he comes over next year, there's very strict spending limitations because he's under 25. In the new CBA, they raised the age of the spending cap on foreign players. It used to be players under 23. Now it's under 25, right? So that's how, you know, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., the Blue Jays could spend whatever they wanted on him because he was 23 years old. Well, if they had done the Gurriel deal today, they would have had some very strict caps on what they could spend on him. So a team, they could trade for pool money and stuff and probably get up to $8 to $10 million as the max bonus that he can be offered. So if he's got a field of teams that are all offering him basically the same bonus, you know, he's going to be treated as an amateur. He still has to come in and do 6 years of service time for free agency, yada, yada. Then you get to, all right, well, how do you separate yourself from the other teams? Well, hey, we'll let you pitch and hit.
Yeah,
we'll let you keep doing this. And that, I think, would be very appealing to him. And that's how a team could lure him, I think.
Where do you think he might end up?
I think the Dodgers are the favorites. A lot of people I talked to believe that he had actually like a handshake agreement with the Dodgers out of high school.
Wow.
To join them. And, you know, you can read about it in the story, but there's a whole controversy over him leaving. He wanted to leave Japan out of high school. He didn't even want to pitch in the NPB. And then a whole bunch of stuff happened and he ended up with the Fighters. Read about it in the story. But so the fact that the Dodgers were close with him at that point, I would imagine that they've at least tried to maintain those ties. I think he ends up with, look, a team with a lot of money. I think it's a big market team because it's, you know, some point, you know, if he continues to perform the way he is, he's going to set arbitration records. I mean, you're going to have to look at extending him, you know, doing an Evan Longoria type of thing with him, right? Like if you want to maintain any kind of cost certainty with this guy. So I think it's going to be a team that has a lot of money. And I think also a team that has a history of Japanese players will be important to him as well. So the Dodgers, obviously. The Red Sox with, you know, Tozawa and Koji Uehara. The Rangers with Yu Darvish. It's important to remember that Shohei Ohtani is very close with Yu Darvish. They've been training together the last two off seasons. He credits Darvish for teaching him a lot of kind of Western techniques to conditioning and especially right. nutrition. So that's how, like, Ohtani's grown a lot over the last few years. And he says Darvish has really helped him with helping him kind of train for explosiveness and train for power, helping him with his diet and with eating and how much to eat and when to eat and what types of foods to eat. So Darvish kind of told him a lot of information that he wasn't getting from Japanese trainers. And he said that's really helped him. So he's kind of already ahead of the curve in terms of being prepared for an MLB lifestyle.
Yeah. Darvish, by the way, a free agent after this offseason.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So any team, maybe a team that signs Darvish could say, hey, you know, hey, we signed your bro.
Yeah.
Come join him.
Yeah, there you go.
Can you imagine that rotation?
That's your rotation right there. That's impressive. That is crazy. Anything else that we should get to here? There's tons of stuff, of course. Great story that we'll link to. But as far as stuff that didn't make it in, stuff that you weren't able to fit into the story, anything stand out?
Oh, man. Stuff, though, there was definitely a lot cut from the story. My first draft was like 10,000 words.
Wow.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. I'm trying to think back.
A novella.
Excuse me?
A novella.
Oh, yeah, no, it was a real opus. I don't know. I mean, it's just he's legit is the thing. I think a lot of people are just trying to find ways to say it's not going to work, you know, and that, look, he's going to come over from the MPB and it's going to be an adjustment and the league's not as good. And, you know, this is like, you can't continue doing this. Like, I don't know, maybe it's a bit hopeful. I kind of have a belief that he could be the first true two-way player in the MLB since Babe Ruth, you know, like really guys have tried and failed miserably. There's been plenty of National League pitchers like, you know, your Zambranos and Bumgarners of this world who could hit a bit. You know, there's been a few relievers who have like tried, you know, to pinch hit.
Travis Wood.
Exactly. But I think that Shohei Ohtani could be honestly the true first like elite two-way player because the tools are so legit and people, you know, try to, you know, detract from him because of the league he plays in. And look, yeah, NPB lineups aren't as deep. And Ohtani doesn't have to face high 90s heat at the plate as often as he would in the MLB. But he's just 22, and he's still developing. And he's already shown, you know, as scouts have told me, he's already shown an ability to make adjustments at an elite level. He's already played on a big stage, Japan series. He's already been the most popular athlete in Japan. He's already dealt with all that stuff. I mean, I think this guy is really well prepared to make a smooth transition into the MLB. And the tools are so good, man. Like we're talking about a fastball that like sits 97, 98, that he can get up into triple digits when he wants to. And the thing is in Japan, he doesn't have to that much because guys are overwhelmed with 98. I don't think he throws as hard as he could as often as he could if he wanted to. Then you talk about a secondary offering of a splitter that looks like the fastball out of the hand, same arm action, comes in a little bit slower still, like 91, 92. And bottoms out like crazy. And scouts told me that he can put that pitch wherever he wants. Like he has great feel for that pitch. So you're going to look foolish. And then his curveball, he flips up at like 75 to 78.
Wow.
On an 11.5 curve. So you're talking about like almost a 30 mile per hour discrepancy from your curve to your fastball. Are you kidding me? How are you going to, you can't sit on anything. And then he throws in a slider, which, you know, is probably his weakest pitch, but is still a good pitch, and keeps guys off of his curveball and gives them something else to look at. And he's working on developing a changeup. He learned his grip from Trevor Hoffman. Pretty good guy to learn a changeup grip from.
Wow.
So, like,
the man is unstoppable.
The pitching tools are phenomenal. And then at the plate, he's got real legit power. I mean, real power. Guys, you know, like, scouts told me, look, he could come over to the majors and hit 20 bombs as, like, a floor. You know, like, he has real, real power. Like, he's got a great swing. He makes good contact. He's got good plate recognition. He took his walks last year, didn't expand the zone. And then you'd factor in that he's a burner on the base paths. And we're, you know, I'm told, I've never seen him play the outfield. I'm told he was good when he played the outfield. The Fighters didn't let him do it last year, probably because they didn't want to overextend him any more than he already was. But a guy who can play a good right field as well. So, like, you can't take away his tools. So you can try to handicap everything and detract this, that, and the other. But the tools are legit. And they're tools that you don't see in the, like, the best prospects in baseball, you know? They're tools that you don't see in those guys. In the majors, I mean. So,
sure.
I think he's going to transfer over to the majors and be very, very successful. And I think he has at least the best shot of being the first true elite two-way player that we've seen in a century.
Since Babe Ruth,
right? Crazy. There's like a section of the story where I'm like, look, I understand that I'm putting a Babe Ruth comp on this guy. It's the only thing he could do, right? Yeah.
Setting the bar pretty high.
Well, what else? Yeah. What else can
you
do?
No, yeah. Of course. You can't say Travis Wood. That's ridiculous, right? Yeah. He's way better as a pitcher. He's way better as a hitter. So it's Babe Ruth.
Look, when Ohtani was 20, he faced, like, the MLB took over that, like, all-star team after the season over to Japan to play the Japanese national team. Ohtani was 20. This is 2014. He struck out 7 in 4 innings against major league, like, MLB all-stars. A lineup that included Yasiel Puig when he was good. Salvador Perez was in that lineup. Ben Zobrist. Jose Altuve was in that lineup. I mean, it was a good, I think Hosmer was in there. Like, it was a good lineup, and Ohtani dominated it, you know? Like, and that's when he was 20 against major league hitters. And then last year, he played Netherlands and Mexico in, like, WBC tune-ups. The real shame is Ohtani's going to miss a WBC with an ankle injury. But he faced Netherlands and Mexico in WBC tune-ups. He went 5 for 11, 2 homers, 4 walks. Two doubles, a homer, 4 walks. He should have had 2 homers, but one, like the second one, he hit so far that it went through the roof at Tokyo Dome. Have you not seen this video?
Oh, yeah, I have seen this video.
It went through the roof of Tokyo Dome, something that has never happened. And if you don't, like, understand how big Tokyo Dome is, it's like the Rogers Center. It's 50,000 plus seat stadium. It's massive. It is huge. He hit a ball to the roof. And not just to the roof, but through the roof. And it was ruled as a ground rule double because, like, the umps were like, we've never seen this happen before. We don't know what to do. Like, why do we score this? So it was like, and that was against, you know, Netherlands and Mexico had major league pitchers. He faced Sergio Romo in that series. You know, he faced good players. And he's done well against major league competition.
That clip is in Arden's story, and the stunned looks on his teammates' faces say it all. So it's definitely worth checking out.
Because nobody had seen this happen before,
yeah.
Right? He does things that you've never seen happen. He set the speed record in Japan for fastest pitch. He set it like 4 times. He's like broken his own record time and again. And like he's just doing things that have never been done before. It's unbelievable.
It's crazy. Great stuff in the story at sportsnet.ca. And you can find more stories like that one. Well, maybe not quite like that one, but you can at least find more stories from Arden on Twitter at Arden's Welling. And we can also look forward to that tabloid photo.
Yeah, no, I'll tweet it, or we can embed it in the post and all that stuff.
Great. Sam McKee, our producer, on Twitter at Sam A. McKee. I'm on Twitter at V. Nicholson Smith. And we will all be back a week from now. Spring training begins on At the Letters. Oh, but don't be scared of me, girl. I can't explain. I know it's for me.